This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hey guys, I'm Dan Clark and this is Screen Talk. Hello, bonjour, hola to all my European listeners. I think there's some. I'm pretty sure they. I know I have a lot of French fans because of my sitcom, and the weird thing is that show's never been broadcast. So I have this mixture of feelings, which is on the one hand, I can't believe I've got French fans. On the other hand, I think they're all illegally downloading my work. How dare they? Apologies in advance if I trip over my words today or just pass out mid-sentence. I'm not high on drugs. I have jet lag. Pretty bad jet lag. I woke up at 2:30 last night, this morning. I never know how you say that if it's AM. Well, it's surely the morning. Anyway, I couldn't get back to sleep, so went into the living room and I started watching things. I tried to watch the film Ordinary People. The Robert Redford film, I've always tried to watch it. Can I just say, if you've ever thought about watching that film, don't watch it at 3 a.m. It's definitely not a 3 a.m. kind of movie. Anyway, so I quit on Ordinary People, and then I did the pilot of Walking Dead, because I've never seen it, and I was immediately hooked. Anyway, that's TV talk. I've got here, as you've already heard him, sort of the charming dulcet tones of Mr. James Gill, the film editor of Shortlist magazine. Can I just quickly ask, James, is Shortlist just a London thing?
No, 12 cities nationwide.
Okay, cool. What's new? What's happening in the world of film, James? How are you, by the way? Just quickly.
I'm good. It's always good to see you, Dan, but because you have been away, you are so brown, you look like Des O'Connor.
Which I'm that was the look I was going for.
Well, mission accomplished, my friend.
Yeah, thank you.
You look incredible.
Oh God! I mean, how did he do that without ever getting skin cancer? I mean, so film news.
Ron Seal. I'm going Ron Seal. Film news. I think the Rogue One trailer has to be the big thing this week, and it just looks
It was
my
cool,
God!
Because in a way, better than Force Awakens. In a way,
I don't know. I mean, certainly, I got as excited. I was surprised by how excited I got over it.
But is it because it's story-wise, it's around the time of the original, so there was a lot of that, you know, using some of the originals.
Maybe, yeah, because he's used some of those original vehicles, hasn't he?
Yeah, and also
he's nailed it.
Oh, I know, it does look amazing.
And I love that they're still using not household names, you know, in the way that Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, etc. were not household names. Same with John Boyega, etc. And the fact that he's picked a few left field choices. So, like Ben Mendelsohn, if you're a film fan, you know that he's an awesome actor, but your average dude on the street doesn't know who Ben Mendelsohn is, so I can't wait to see.
Does that mean though that Ben Mendelsohn's playing a psychotic bad guy in, for, you know,
probably,
you know, because whenever he pops up, I go, okay, he'll be the bad guy, because he always is.
He's so good, isn't he? That looks awesome.
The problem is, on that note though, unlike Yesteryear, which I do a lot of in this show,
there
wasn't so much fucking stuff to watch.
Yesteryear, a film came out every year.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, it's almost, I would say, there are 6 or 7 releases at the cinema per week, pretty much.
And then there's Netflix, Amazon, and the DVD collection I've built up over the years that some of them I still haven't even unwrapped.
One thing that I'm fascinated by is the films that go straight to DVD that have good people in them.
Well, now that I think the straight to DVD thing is, well, because it's VOD, what do they call it? Like simultaneous release now. So a lot of films get released at the same time as the cinema.
That's right.
Because, you know, there's this whole thing that smaller films just don't do well at the cinema. So now I think that stigma of straight to DVD is finally starting to go. Like, I wouldn't be embarrassed if I made a
Dan
film.
Dan Clark, the movie.
Yeah.
You'd be like, all right, I'll take that.
Yeah. Well, I'd be embarrassed by that movie. I don't know. What is that?
Who would play you in Dan Clark, the movie?
Well, if I didn't get the role for that, I mean, I'd know that I really am not hot at the moment, that I can't even play myself in a movie.
Des O'Connor, if you're listening.
Fuck you. So, Rogue One is called. That's very exciting. What else have we got?
So the new, I've seen, this is more bragging than anything else, I've seen the documentary that goes with the Blu-ray of The Force Awakens. It's 69 minutes long. I sound like I'm working for Disney. if you're a Star Wars fan, you have to buy the double disc edition because the documentary is awesome.
Is it?
Yeah, my wife is not a Star Wars fan. I put the documentary on last night and even she was like, this is amazing.
What is the kind of narrative of it?
So, I mean, it's very... What comes across is the love that everyone has, the enthusiasm on it. John Boyega looks like he's won a competition. Yeah. He is so
happy.
Well,
he sort of has.
But, I mean, but, and you love it. It's so endearing. The behind-the-scenes footage is incredible. You've got excerpts from board meetings when they announce to the board that they've got J.J. Abrams on board.
They've gone for it.
They have absolutely
from
gone
the very,
for it.
They're like filming conversations over the urinal. There.
Yes, this is more than just a puff piece. There's so much to it. The behind the scenes stuff, the on location shoots. They go back into the archives from the original movies. They've got so much stuff stored away, and it videos the crew of The Force Awakens going through all the original props and what have you. It is awesome. It really is.
Here's my question for you. Do you feel like... I love that stuff.
Yes.
Like, I love it. As a film fan, as someone that makes and creates stuff as well, I'm a huge, huge fan. I loved it when DVDs first started coming out and there were commentaries, there were behind the scenes. But do you feel... Is there an argument for this is slightly ruining the magic of the wonder of movies?
No, I would say the opposite, because that documentary is so good that by the time the credits roll at the end, I was almost off my sofa. It made it even more magical, and it made you wish that you were John Boyega or you know, anyone associated with that film. Oh, right, this is a good story from the DVD extra, the documentary. There was a dude who was a hobbyist, and his hobby was building R2-D2s. He did it for fun. He ended up meeting Kathleen Kennedy at a convention and cheekily said, if you ever make another Star Wars film, here's my details. A few months later, that dude got an email, would you like to operate R2-D2 on The Force Awakens?
That is cool.
Yeah, it's pretty
But
awesome.
It also now makes a lot of people go, well, why isn't that happening to me? No? Maybe I'm just too cynical.
But I think so, yeah. I put it this way, tonight I will be dressing up as C-3PO on the off chance that there is a role.
Okay.
No, I mean, I wish I'd not said that
out loud. I could see you as a good C-3PO.
Yeah, polite.
Yeah. A bit camp.
Yes, I will take
very
that.
Camp.
A very camp, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah,
they just when they were pitching C-3PO, did they go, it's Camp Tin Man. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, because when you're a little boy, when you watch it, you don't realise that. But the older you get, I mean, it's borderline John Inman.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not borderline. It's pretty full-on John Inman.
And that is a good thing.
And their relationship is very questionable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong, with that. Same-sex robot love.
Absolutely. Inter-droid shenanigans.
So something I read about yesterday was that the Warners have confirmed that Ben Affleck is going to direct a standalone Batman film.
And again, that is, I think, a wonderful thing, because Affleck has got such a beautiful eye when it comes to directing, and I thought he was wonderful as Batman in Batman vs. Superman. Yeah. So, again, I'm excited.
I just hope that... Because when you enter the world of comic book stuff, the reaction to it can be really... quite harsh, or it can be dividing or whatever. He's got such an impeccable director's CV now.
Like,
really amazing. I mean, I still think, in some respects, Gone Baby Gone is his best film. Yeah.
It's a great film. And if you've read any of the Dennis Lehane books, I think I've read every book that Dennis Lehane...
Really?
Yeah, and I wish that film had done better, because there are so many more Kenzie and Gennaro novels that would make awesome movies.
Who else plays that? Aren't they in Casey Mystic Affleck? River or something?
No, different. The detectives, Kenzie and Gennaro, I think there are five, maybe six books.
I'm sure they're in another adaptation of...
Oh, really?
I'm sure they are.
Okay.
I could be wrong. Tweet in if you know.
Kenzie and Gennaro, Mystic River. I've seen that movie, but I don't remember.
Maybe it's not them.
Okay.
Sure they're in another... I'm sure I remember reading that.
Right,
anyway.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so tweet in if you... So you're excited about that. I am excited, but I kind of want him to... I think he does that crime... movie, that sort of almost 70s crime genre thing so well.
Gritty.
It'll be interesting. Maybe he'll do something that none of the directors of Batman have done yet, which will be interesting.
Given Affleck's gritty eye, and, you know, if you've probably read the Batman comics as well.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think he lends himself well to that.
Yeah, I'm not as This is the problem for me as a film lover. I don't, you know, I like the odd Superman, superhero movie, comic book. I do like good ones, but I'm not as anyone that comes out, I've got to go and see it. And it feels like if you're not a huge comic book fan in this day and age, then you're kind of in the minority.
Yeah,
which is weird. I feel like how comic book fans used to feel in the sort of 70s and 80s, where only one of the type of films they like come out. Do you know what I mean? You're looking at me as if to say,
no,
wow.
I'm soaking it all in. I'm looking at you in awe.
It's almost as if from February to November, that's all it is. It's just, and then you get this little like 3-month period where the Oscar films come out, where they sort of release the kind of films that I'm tend to be into.
I would say that the facts would back you up there. That is pretty much.
But when how they it works. When you get a good, like, I still maintain that the middle.
What's the best
Dark
superhero
Knight,
film ever?
I think it's The Dark Knight, but I don't like either of the other two.
Oh, I love Batman Begins. Is
really?
Oh my god! Yeah, absolutely.
Really? I just feel like that what it suffers from is a not a brilliant villain. You're a bit confused. Is it him? Is it who's the?
The bit with about you haven't given up on me, Alfred, and the way Michael Caine goes, never. Just I was absolute Niagara Falls in the Streatham Odeon.
I also like Iron Man's 1 and 3 a lot.
Yeah. 3's hilarious, isn't it?
A good friend of mine co-wrote that.
Stop it.
Yeah.
You're joking.
No. I've got a really good story about that, but we don't have time for it. So we'll do it next time. I know. We'll do it next
story,
time.
Tweet in.
But my friend Drew Pearce wrote it.
You're friends with Drew Pearce?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
And he is a comic book fan. And so I hang around with them. It's just not me.
Wow.
We'll talk about that another time. So what else? Have we got anything else before we...
Yes, we wanted to talk the Swiss Army Man trailer.
Oh, yes, of course. I mentioned that to you. You looked at me confused, like, what? It is a bit like that when you watch the trailer. But what I liked about it, it sort of reminded me a bit of when I very first heard of...
Weekend at Bernie's?
Weekend at Bernie's. I guess it is a Weekend at Bernie's. That's quite a good... So for those of you that haven't seen it, check it out. Swiss Army Man is a film where Paul Dano is stranded on a tropical island. And it looks like he's, you know, he's at a very desperate point in the journey of this story when all of a sudden Daniel Radcliffe's dead body washes up to shore and he befriends it. He befriends the corpse and uses it in ways that, well...
Might surprise you.
Yeah.
It's
a necrophilia film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just 2 hours of them going at it. It's a bit like Castaway, but except instead of Wilson the ball, it's...
Wilson the dead body.
Wilson the Harry Potter.
Yeah. Which, and by the way, I love the fact that Daniel Radcliffe is making these really bizarre choices post-Harry Potter.
I say, you've got to applaud that, I think.
Yeah.
God bless him. There's something in that, isn't there?
Yeah.
In going for those left-field choices.
Well, I think he knows he's never going to be able to repeat the success of Harry Potter.
Sure.
In terms of
so he's got the money in the bank.
Yeah.
As Jim Bowen would say, the money's safe.
Money's safe.
So just enjoy it, Daniel, and then
do you think he'll turn up and go, Daniel, here's what you could have won. And it's a post-Harry Potter career that was... it really excited me. That it wasn't Weekend at Bernie's, it reminded me of it. It reminded me a bit of Warm Bodies, which was a film I enjoyed. And... a bit like when I very first heard of Being John Malkovich. And I thought,
what a movie that is.
How? What? Really? They're doing that? It's just very hard to be surprised by a story. Not necessarily the way someone directs something, but like an idea.
Yeah.
Every idea's been done, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, even that, which seems like an original idea, we've already compared to Castaway and Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah. So not original at all. But
it does look good. I mean,
if you like that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you, James. I know it's a short one today. Unless there was something else you're desperate to talk about.
Michael Keaton possibly being in the new Spider-Man
movie. I could talk about Michael Keaton for hours. I think you and I need a show where we can just...
Michael Keaton Appreciation Society.
And I'll tell you about Drew Pearce. And I'm sure there was something from the other week that we were going to talk about as well.
Yeah, there was.
So go on, Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton is possibly going to be the villain in the new Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Homecoming is the title that's just been revealed. But Keaton is so awesome. Have you ever seen him on Letterman?
Yes.
Just
amazing.
Consistently
He was
hilarious.
A stand-up back in the
he
day.
He was a stand-up back in the day. And there are not many people that Letterman genuinely finds funny.
Yeah.
I think I can safely say that. But Keaton would have Letterman in Gales of Laughter. He was. I remember him once.
I've never heard that. Gales of Laughter.
I may have just made it up. Tweet in if I think Des O'Connor told me all about it. So Michael Keaton obviously went through a period before the other guys where some of it, you know, some of his films weren't as successful as they had been. I can safely say that.
I think, let's say, in terms of mainstream success,
yes,
he was...
mainstream success would have been a more polite way of saying
it. He was a slightly...
I remember him going on Letterman saying that in something like, in my last five... I'm not saying that my last five films haven't done that well, but I turned up wearing the Batman costume and no one noticed. And David Letterman must have laughed for what felt like an hour.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'm very excited about seeing him in another... Even though, like what I said about comic book adaptations, when they're good and they've got good cast, good story, I love them. And the idea of Keaton playing a bad guy, because I love him so
Keaton
much.
Keaton is awesome.
Now, we haven't got as much time today because I interviewed a brilliant writer, Tess Morris, pre-recorded this interview, and it went on for an hour and 45 minutes.
Good skills.
So we had to cut out so much, and I'm sorry, Tess, that we had to do that. We are talking about doing slightly more longer versions of the podcast, but for the radio show, this is the interview I did with her. She wrote the film Man Up, starring Simon Pegg, Your Lookalike, and Lake Bell, and we discussed at length rom-coms.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
So here we have with me, we're very lucky to have Tess Morris.
Did you forget my surname?
No, I didn't, but I was going to, for some reason I was going to say your middle name even though I don't know it.
Oh, it's Joe.
Joe.
But my full name is Tessa Joe Morris.
Tessa?
Yes, but no one calls me that unless they're angry. My dad still calls me.
That is the laziest abbreviation of a name I've ever heard in my life. One letter. So I can't be bothered to say Tessa.
No. Well, no, but I felt like as a writing name, Tessa Morris sounded really formal. And I started calling myself Tess when I was about... Well, I've always been called Tess. And then I started officially calling myself Tess in my teens.
It also just sounds like someone you're slightly hesitating. Tessa Morris.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Tessa.
Like you are... You can't remember your surname.
No, but you clearly couldn't.
Yeah, I know I could, but I do this joke about like saying people's middle names. I say joke, that in the loosest sense of the word. It's not that funny. But thank you for joining me. This is part of my continuation of interviewing people in Los Angeles.
The city of angels.
The city of angels. I've not seen an angel yet.
And also, every time I call it that, people go, you know, no one actually calls it that. And I say, well, I call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, but people must somewhere call it that. Because
yeah, I think
that's
maybe only people
as.
Like us.
Yeah.
The romanticism of the city of angels.
Yeah. Do you like it here?
I love it here. Yes.
Okay, that's nice. And you moved here for work reasons?
I moved here for both personal and professional, business and leisure.
Yeah, leisure.
Leisure, well, you know, if you were to put it on, you know, when they make you do the immigration thing at passport control. And for ages, I could only put leisure because obviously I didn't have my visa and everything. And then finally, I could put business.
Do you think they could retroactively kick you out of the country?
Well, they can.
The lies that you told back then on
maybe. But they quiz you so intensely at immigration. And at one point they say, like, I remember the first time I came back here after about a year and a half ago, and they said, and I hadn't put my zip code on the form.
Yeah.
And they said, we can let you into the country if you haven't got your zip code. So I just went 90210, just like the only one that I know. They were like, and they looked at me like, ma'am, that's not your zip code, is it? I was like,
what, because of the way you were dressed or something?
No, I think they were very, you know, they just pick you. And then because I was so nervous once they said that, you know, then they like scan your fingers and my hand was shaking thing. I know.
I get so nervous at customs. You know the question on the form that says, are you or have you ever been involved in espionage or terrorism? I get so nervous that I'm like, God, I don't know, maybe I have.
Maybe I have, inadvertently.
Maybe they've erased my memory. And then when I get through the other side, they'll put it back in.
Yeah.
And that's quite a good idea.
That's quite a good idea for a film, yeah. Maybe it's like
it's
the Bourne.
Total Recall or...
Meets Bourne. Identity.
The Long Kiss Goodbye. I mean, it's been done a lot.
It's been done a lot. I would say The Long Kiss Goodnight does it the best.
Yes. You are a writer.
I am.
A screenwriter.
I am.
Is that is can you be a screenwriter if you do TV, or is that purely?
You know
TV?
What? I think, but maybe now yes, because the small screen has become the big screen.
Yeah.
But historically speaking, no. I mean, screenwriting was always films, and it's like the boring script writer was TV, wasn't it? Doesn't sound as glamorous, nice, does it? Is it? No. It's not adventures in the script trade, is it? but I feel like now you could say screenwriter, also because everyone does both. You know, most people do film and TV. So,
in fact, a lot of people are screenwriters.
A lot of people. You know what? You meet a lot of screenwriters in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. A lot, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Some of them are. And some of them aren't.
I've seen very successful, like I've seen people I've seen on TV shows working behind bars.
Yes.
Or driving me in an Uber. And then they're not, they don't seem like, if that was me, I'd be cripply embarrassed. Like, oh, what must they be?
But that's because you're British, Dan. So you're embarrassed that, like, oh God, someone's
actually. What are people thinking of me?
Yeah. They don't, why would you care? You're like, maybe you've been for an audition in the day that you might get tomorrow, but tonight you're driving that Uber. Yeah. Like, it's a positive thing, I think. Like, and if you do pick me up in an Uber next week, I won't judge you.
But so when you had the idea,
yes,
you then decided you were going to write it.
Yes.
Did you spec it, I presume?
Yes.
Yeah. You had read the book at that point?
Yes.
So you'd worked out your structure.
Yes. And then I took 3 months to write it.
Great.
I will never, ever have as good an experience as I did on Man Up. Like, it's fucked me for life. Because
you enjoyed the actual process.
I enjoyed writing it.
You were there typing away.
Oh my God. I was like Diane Keaton in Something's Gotta Give when she's at the, you know, when she's crying but enjoying it all because it's just like, this is all happening. Like I've never experienced that before in my life. I sat there, I wrote it. I had a friend, Aaron, who used to read it for me, read it in stages, and we'd meet up and like have a cup of tea, and he talked me through like his notes and stuff. And at every point he was like, this is good. This is good. And I'd be like, fuck, I know. It's like not that shit. What's going on? What's happening? And then I finished it. And I remember getting to the end. It was like 101 pages. I was so pleased. It was like so tight. And I sent it to my agent and I said, Dear Julia, you haven't heard from me for a while. Here's the script, Man Up. It's not shit. And that's all I knew at the point. You know, I was like, I'm not saying it's the greatest thing ever written, but I know it's not shit.
The best pitch in the world.
Best pitch ever for your agent. And then I went off to New York for a week and roamed the streets on my own, looking at the Fat Cats in Bleecker Street Records and like just having a weird old time.
This sounds
like
such an amazing romantic.
It'll never be like this again. Cool, but don't get me wrong, I'm like weeping in corners on Fifth Avenue. I'm not like totally all right.
Yeah,
I'm just
an emotional mess.
Yeah, I'm a mess, but I'm definitely not a hot mess. I'm like because I hate that phrase so much. It's just the death of so many things that phrase. But I'm messy. I'm definitely messy.
In a sort of from like a Woody Allen film.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am.
You're in, you know, lower Manhattan.
Yes, just having a little cry in the corner.
Yes.
And then I got back, and my agent rang me and was like, "It's not shit. It's good. It's really good." I said, "Oh, like Jesus Christ, really?" Because I sent it to like a few people. Like I have like people that I will always let read my stuff who I trust implicitly, and they'd all said, "No, it's quite good." But you know, your agent's the one, isn't it?
Yeah,
that you're like. Yeah, and then this will never happen again to me. It was like everyone liked it. So that was sort of like how it all happened. And then even...
And did Simon being attached, did that speed it up?
He didn't come attached for a year after they optioned it. I did another... Basically, the first draft of Man Up was very walkie-talkie. It was very... it could have been done like I could... My plan was, if no one liked it, that I would just like make it myself on the South Bank.
Version.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't hadn't really like expanded the universe and made it cinematic, and that's what Rachel did. So we spent probably about 6 months to a year redrafting, and me kind of like opening it up a bit more, and set pieces, stuff like that, like the reflex dance I put in, and like the run with the kids and stuff like that. But nothing ever really changed structurally.
It was like, I'm actually getting to make this.
Yes, we'll I know.
40 kids instead of 5. Yay.
Well, actually, there were no kids, I don't think, originally. I think, I can't remember. No, did he always run with the kids? I think he always did.
Were you happy with how it came out?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I wasn't happy with that it didn't do insanely well. I mean, you know, like, because it's impossible to, like, get people to go to the cinema. Yeah. I mean, it didn't do badly. I mean, we did, like, 1 million like I think overall in the UK, but obviously, you know, if we'd come out maybe 10, 15 years ago, we might have done that in a weekend. So,
well, that sort of
look at me talking about finances. I'm so happy with the film. I love the film that got made. Yeah. Like, I think,
and you love the process.
I love the process. I absolutely. I suppose the reason I'm saying that is that, like, I'm so passionate about romantic comedies that I wanted it to be. It's actually proving to be is actually a lovely slow burn. Yeah. Like, people find it in their own way now, and that's really, really lovely. And that's only sort of come about in the last 6 months. Whereas at the time when it came out last year, I remember thinking, oh, and we got the usual snidey fucking reviews by the broadsheets who were like, oh, and you're like, fuck off. You're like, it's a romantic comedy. We're not trying to be like subvert the formula, and we're not trying to be cool, and we're not trying to say, you know, like, this is what it is. So, like, if you're going to hate it because you don't like the content or you don't like, I don't know, the story. Don't slag it off. Like, one of the reviewers gave us one star and talked about Lake's bobble hat.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was kind
Christ.
Of like, okay, look, I can cope with people not liking the film. But if you're going to review it badly, review it properly, like with some panache. Don't slag it off because she wears a rom-com woolly hat in it. It was cold on the South Bank.
See, I don't know if I would prefer people, in a way, if someone slagged it off because of the character's hat.
Well, it's better, I know what you mean.
At least I got away with any personal, anything aimed at me.
No, I mean,
as the writer.
Yeah, I mean, but actually.
No, I mean, it's so unfair, and, you know, I have a real problem with critics and with the way things are reviewed. I think it's good to have them, but I just think there's a lot of bad ones, and when people put years of their life into something for someone who can sometimes are influential to completely dismiss an entire, you know, piece of work that just so many people, just because they've got their own little sort of agenda or short attention span or like beef with rom-coms.
But exactly that. And I think it's also really weird. For me, like, the best critics, you know, like Kermode and all the people that, they are cineasts and they adore cinema. And if he doesn't like something, he's got damn fucking good reasons for why he didn't like it. And they're also hilarious reasons sometimes as well.
And sometimes he will say, look, you know, I don't particularly, you know, I love
it's not
the film,
for me.
But it's not the greatest film in the world.
Exactly.
Or the other way
I love
around.
It when he gets, when he waxes lyrical about something like The Notebook. He's like, I just love a Nicholas Sparks. Sue me. And, you know, like, but he also understands the genre of that film. And he's saying, okay, so I'm not the audience for this. Like, he loves Twilight. I mean, I love that he loves Twilight. But
I actually quite like the first one.
Yeah, I love the first one's quite
and
good.
And I watch it because I wrote something about vampires and I'd never seen any of the Twilight films, and I had to watch lots of vampire films.
Yeah.
Lots. Things I would never normally watch. And I was like, right, here we go. I was like,
it's a well made movie, and it's about something.
I didn't watch the other 40.
No,
though,
you don't need to watch those probably. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that I am overly sensitive about romantic comedies because I love it as a genre, and I feel like if the amount of headlines that are like, you know, it's dead or it's alive or it's shit or it's whatever, I'm like, if we don't have romantic comedies, what the fuck? Yeah. Because I don't just want to watch superhero movies. And I love superhero movies, but I don't just want to watch those. I don't just want to watch thrillers. I don't just want to watch like in-depth films about whatever. I want to watch films about life. And
my question to you, and this was going to be a big part of the interview, is can rom-coms ever be successful again? And I ask that from the point of view of rom-coms. A lot of story plot lines, premises of rom-coms have kind of been ruined because of social media, mobile phones, people's standards, social standards, as in like one night stands or like you said a minute ago, fucking in the bathroom.
I think people did that in the 60s as well, to be fair.
I know, but there was still this like pretense that you can't do that or that you would be seen as...
Yeah, whereas now it's all out there.
It's kind of like, I mean, romantic comedies from pre-60s were almost entirely based on Airs and Graces and like, I can't really tell that person what I really think. And
I mean, like... Although then that said, you've got kind of more the screwball-y sort of Spencer Tracy. Yeah, but I see
like,
what you mean.
We hate each other,
yeah,
really
but
we
love
each
other.
Other,
yeah.
Whereas now it's sort of, I mean, you could still have that, I guess, but people don't have to go through the long, arduous process of of dating and stuff if they didn't want to. Whereas I think for a long time there was this sense that we still go on three or four dates before you.
Yeah, but I think the challenge is, I think, well, the issue is that is more that romantic comedies are now much more on television than ever. So you've got fantastic shows like Catastrophe and Togetherness, which got cruelly cancelled when it should never have got cancelled. And so you've got lots of these kind of things that would have previously probably been more played out. Like the premise of Catastrophe is also very cinematic, you know, mm-hmm. a couple like get pregnant, you know, on a one night stand and then spend the course of the movie like working out their shit, you know.
Knocked up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I mean. So you've got, but also even like a small show like Togetherness plays out these romantic comedy strands on the smaller screen.
And that kind of Catastrophe thing you could see is a perfect arc for a film.
Totally.
You can have the conclusion at the end.
But now we can binge watch television. So now you can watch all of Catastrophe like you're watching, you can watch those six episodes like
the
a movie.
Rom-com ever made.
Exactly. Well, it's only like two, what would it be? It would still only be like just over 2.5 hours or something and whatever. 3 hours?
These, you know, those, there'd be more roms than just rom-coms.
Yeah, they'd be really, yeah, droms. I personally believe that there is. I think the trick is how to get people to see them now. Because
you mean literally how you get people in the cinema?
Yes,
or yeah,
because that is an overall problem for cinema in itself. Because people just go, I'm going to wait for DVD. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to, like, and the only films that people go and see at the cinema now tend to be event cinema sort of things or whatever. But if you can find, like, look at something like Silver Linings Playbook, which is a classic romantic comedy. And they were going to do a very small release and then it started to get awards buzz. And then they did a mass, you know, they like suddenly rolled it out in a load more cinemas and then it won a lot of awards. And it never got called a romantic comedy because it won awards, essentially. It's 100% a romantic comedy.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you about certain films that I was looking at a list of the greatest rom-coms.
Yeah.
And there are films in there that I go, well, is that technically a rom-com?
Oh.
And I guess it's when, if it has comedy and a romance in it, does that mean, therefore, it's a rom-com?
Well,
because rom-com, I guess, in its most crass version is a film that is more of a chick flick in its, you know, as a dirty word, rom-com.
Yes, as a dirty word, as opposed to the Annie Hall rom-com.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It basically, a romantic comedy, by very definition, you...
the story meets girl, loses girl,
no, the story has to be driven by a want and desire to do with love. So, and if you take that out of the story and you don't have a story, then it's not a rom-com. You see what I mean? So if you took...
So in Silver Linings Playbook, they could have maybe not got together at the end, but the film still would have worked.
Yeah, but it's driven. What it is Silver Linings Playbook.
They could have been friends.
They could have been friends at the end, and it would still be a romantic comedy. People find it's more what your actual story structure is that make, and it has to obviously be funny as well as being romantic. So it's more that like the central premise of the film is to do with two people's chemical equation, really, isn't it? So if they did, if there was no spark between Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence's characters and there wasn't a subtext everything they were doing, then you wouldn't really have, you wouldn't be telling a story, you'd just be telling a man, you know, if you took her out of it and he just ran around in his bin liners and then met her and helped her dance and then found himself, that wouldn't be a romantic comedy. But because it's driven by their relationship and the love that subsequently unfolds between them, that makes it a romantic comedy.
Okay. There, it seems to me like it's also other films as well. So it's kind of like a genre blend.
Yeah, I mean, you can have, that's the other thing now. So, you know, Romancing the Stone is an action romantic comedy.
I love that film.
Yeah, who doesn't
so
love that
much.
But that adheres 100% to the seven beats of a romantic comedy. Her setup, her chemical, the cute meet when she's under the bus and there's his, you know, his lizard print boot. What then ties them together at the end of Act One, that she says to him, you've got to take me to Cartagena.
Oh my God.
You know, even the midpoint when they sexy timed up and dance it when they're in, you know, like it absolutely 100% follows a romantic comedy formula, but it's got action, it's an action hybrid.
So when she discovers that he's actually just been not
Yes, well, about the money.
He was originally doing that, but then he changed. That's classic rom-com
classic.
As well.
Classic. So at the end of Act 2, when she realises that, everything is lost, isn't it?
So in Man Up, there's the moment where he finds out, but she has fallen for this guy.
My end of
that beat happens a lot in rom-coms, right? Where one person started doing something for cynical reasons, but then actually continues doing it because they genuinely like the other
and
person.
Usually they don't reveal. What I did in Man Up is actually she tells him at the end of Act One that she tells him the truth because she doesn't think he's going to care. And my end of Act One break is actually like he does fucking care and he's furious with her. And traditionally that beat might have come later in another, but I did it earlier because I wanted to unlock the actual screwballness of their relationship and them to have this kind of weird intense night. And then actually my when everything is lost is when they both don't man up at the station, when she's saying, do you want to, he basically goes, oh, she's been calling me the other girl. And she's like, oh, really? And then neither of them say, fuck, we just had an amazing time. What are we doing? Come with me. He can't do that because he's too vulnerable. And she can't do that because she doesn't want to be like rejected again. So it's like
In a way you do the opposite of the classic, rom-com of two people hating each other from the start.
No, I like them. They're into each other at the beginning. That's sort of the whole point. But they're also not really being themselves at the beginning.
Yeah.
And actually by being themselves, when they start to fight and get drunk and it all gets out of control, that's when they start to like each other because then they're actually being themselves. So I always say she's pretending to be someone that she's not, but so is he at the beginning because he's doing all his first date things and he's actually not really being who he truly is.
I'm just looking at some of the list of films that, like Harold and Maud. Would you call that a rom-com?
Yes, that is actually structured rom-com, but it's obviously a slightly sort of darker sort of one. Moonrise Kingdom, I would not say.
The Apartment
100%
is
a romantic comedy.
Maybe in my top three films of all time.
Yeah, amazing film. What's the last line of it? Shut up and deal. I love that last line.
Four Weddings.
Yes, 100%. High Fidelity, 100%. Philadelphia Story, 100%. Say Anything, yes. Eternal Sunshine, yes.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fucked up one, but it structurally is, yeah. Yep. Manhattan, okay. Correct.
So the important question is, the question on everyone's lips, what is your favourite all-time rom-com?
Well...
And if that's too difficult a question
to ask...
Yeah,
I cannot possibly answer that.
Give me your top three.
Oh, fuck. Moonstruck.
Okay.
When Harry Met Sally. I mean, I can't even pick a third because it's just like...
It's too many.
It's too many. You know what? A film that I really love that people forget is a romantic comedy is As Good As It Gets.
Oh, yeah.
I love As Good As It Gets.
It's a great film, yeah.
Yeah. And again, won awards, so didn't get put in the rom-com sort of bracket, but it's very much one.
Dramedy.
It's not a dramedy.
My favourites. I'm a huge Woody Allen fan.
Yes.
I love Annie Hall.
I love
Annie
Hall.
I adore it.
Yes.
But to me, if you're going, if what you want from a rom com is romance, where you desperately want the couple to get together at the end.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah.
And like minute by minute laughs, like big laugh out loud.
Yes.
I would say that When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, that's the one.
Is the one. But the irony of that is it's so heavily influenced by Annie Hall.
Yes, and Annie Hall's interesting because essentially...
But Annie Hall's a more groundbreaking film, but I think as a rom-com...
Yeah, like, you said like, it like my dad then, rom-com.
Do you know what I mean? It's like if it was films, then probably Annie Hall would be higher on my list.
Yes, and Annie Hall...
But if it's rom-com...
Yeah, but Annie Hall's interesting because from the beginning, you know these two people should not be together properly. Yeah. And...
So there isn't like there's the stakes and there's this house that's going
to play
out.
Well, I think it's more like, I mean, to be honest, if I'm truly, truly honest, I once had an argument with Simon Pegg about this. A friendly argument on set. Because I was like, I kind of want them to be together at the end. And he was like, no, that's the whole point. And I was like, and I understand that point of view. But the part of me is like, we've been through this hour and a half together.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't like the term anti-rom-com when people are like, well, I'm writing a rom-com that's not really a rom-com. It's like, look, it either is a rom-com, dude, or it isn't.
Yeah.
They don't have to fall in love and be married. I don't think in Man Up that Jack and Nancy stay together, just for the record. I think they They get it on in a bath and quickie at the end. They may have a nice time for a year or so, but I don't think they're together forever. Like, that's not...
Wow,
like,
you've just broken my heart. I know, you do realize I know.
People often look at me when I say that, and I'm like, that's because I'm writing the sequel, essentially, now. I see. So I have to, like...
a quickie in the bathroom and a week. Yeah.
Yes.
So this was what I was going to mention earlier, right? The other problem with rom-coms is how... And I kind of touched upon it with social media and mobile phones and things. A lot of rom-coms really hinge on this notion that two people can't be together.
Yes.
Like, for there's something getting in the way of these two people, whether it's, you know, someone's from, you know, poor background and the other person's from a rich background, it's a class thing, or whether it's because someone's lied about who they are. And to come up with new ways of inventing the thing that's stopping people from being together is really difficult.
Yeah, but the most important thing that should stop people to getting together is themselves. So,
In terms of writing character and stuff. But when you're like watching the trailer and you're like, this guy has met this girl, but he can't. That's why I thought Chasing Amy. Whether I haven't seen it in a long time.
No, I haven't watched it.
Horrible feeling that if I rewatch it, I'll be like, ugh,
no, I
really?
Think it would probably still stand
but
up.
At the time, I thought, wow, this is brilliant.
Well, and you know why? Because it's got the other thing that I think is the challenge now if you write romantic comedy is just to come up with a good hook, like a good, like when that happened to me, Under the Clock, I was like, that's a good fucking hook. That's a good...
Under the Clock.
Yeah.
That could have been a good title.
Under the Clock. And we had a few other titles, let me tell you. But like, I don't think... For me, what I love is the challenge of going, like the new one that I'm writing that I won't say because like I'm sort of knee deep in it at the moment, but it's... I like a high concept in a lo-fi world, you know? So your concept is your actual emotional stuff is kind of grounded in reality, but you put onto that. I mean, I love 80s movies, so there's a reason why I like those kind of sort of things. It's like, but I think nowadays the ones that aren't doing it very well are basically just trying to, the only obstacle is like, it's not very realistic or interesting. It's just them, it's almost too narcissistic now. Mm-hmm. It's people are going, oh, I don't want to get together with you because there's loads of other people out there. And it's like, that's not interesting, you know?
Or commitment issues.
Commitment issues. And what you want is something clever. In fact, there's a film someone recommended to me the other day that I really like the sound of because I actually wrote a short film of the version years ago, which is about a girl who, they have a one night stand and then the condom splits and essentially, I think it's called The Pill, and he basically stays with her to make sure she takes the pill over a duration of 24 hours, and obviously over that 24 hours they start, you know. So I mean, I don't think it's a total romantic comedy by all accounts, but I like that. Me, like, that's interesting. So you're throwing two people together in a weird, fucked up modern way, but you're still dealing with real life emotions.
Just before we play your song, which I think is a perfect song in terms of in context of everything we've talked about. Before we do that, my probably, if someone asked me my guilty pleasure film, and I'm so embarrassed to say this, but it falls into the rom-com because I do love rom-coms, and even the modern chick-flicky version.
I do too. Dick flicks.
Mine's The Holiday.
Everyone fucking loves that film, and you know what? It's my least favorite Nancy Myers. But I respect. Really,
surely it's better than what women want, isn't
it? Yeah, that's true. You know what? The Holiday is a complex thing. I don't hate, I certainly don't dislike it. Like, but the amount of people who love that film, and I love that about it, actually, that endears me more to it.
Does
you know?
That say there's hope for the genre?
Well, I think Nancy Myers is like a one woman hope thing. Her films fucking do gangbusters at the, you know, at the box office still. I mean, you know.
I'm not a huge fan across the board. I quite enjoyed It's Complicated.
I love It's Complicated. I love Something's Gotta Give. I love Private Benjamin.
I just feel...
There's some that are not her greatest, but you know what? Like,
I don't know what it is. I think I was a bit down at the time. It was Christmas.
Also, it's a Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas film. It was on ITV3 for the millionth time.
You know what?
And for whatever reasons, the stars aligned that I was in the right headspace to watch one of the most schmaltzy movies and overly, you know, post-productioned movies. But like, everything looks like a painting.
But it's got a brilliant hook. Two people, you know, like, it's... I will never, you know, it's not one of my faves, weirly, and everyone always thinks it would be.
Can I just say that's why it's my guilty pleasure, because know it's not.
But you shouldn't feel guilty.
I do.
But why?
Because...
That phrase, guilty pleasure, is so ridiculous. It's like, if you enjoy something, just fucking enjoy it. Just enjoy it.
Do you say that, do you go up to crack addicts and say, look, stop feeling guilty, just enjoy it.
Enjoy it. Well, no, I mean it. When people will be like I openly, like, I don't go, I'm not embarrassed about any of the things I like, I guess that's what I'm saying. Okay. It's like, so I don't feel like, oh God, sorry, but I like that film. I'm like, I like that film.
I'm like, deeply, deeply ashamed. I actually go to a group every Wednesday.
Well, I'm telling you now, Anonymous. There's nothing to be ashamed about.
Okay, well, look, we're going to play from Pretty Woman. This this seems perfect for today's subject. Well, this is a beast of a pop hit from probably, you know, maybe the mother of all rom-coms.
Well, also, just to be a bit geeky about Pretty Woman as a film, someone said to me the other day, oh, Pretty Woman, it's just about, like, you know, a prostitute who then, like, gets rich. And I'm like, no. Pretty Woman is about judgment. Everyone in that film judges everyone. So from us judging her that she's a prostitute, from Richard Gere judging her, from the Hector, you know, the guy in the hotel who judges her, from
all the people in the shops,
all the people around
them.
And that's why it's so good, because it is really so about something. And the whole soundtrack is great to Pretty Woman. Let's not forget about
including the title song.
Yes, and let's not forget about It Must Have Been Love by Roxette.
Oh my god.
But yeah, I do feel, I don't know why, this one, when you asked me to pick one, I was going through all my favourite things and I was just thinking, I just love this song in this film.
Well, let's play it. It's King of Wishful Thinking.
I don't need to fall at your feet just 'cause you cut me to the bone. And I won't miss the way that you kiss me. We were never carved in stone. If I don't listen to the talk of the town, then maybe I can fool myself. I'll get over you. I know I will. I'll pretend my ship's not sinking. And I'll tell myself I'm over you. 'Cause I'm the king.
Yeah. tune.
It's great.
As my mum would say.
So, you're... not guilty pleasure. You've yes. broken the rules of this.
I know, game. Sorry. I know.
You wanted to talk about this film so badly.
I know.
That you were willing to completely...
No.
...override anything that we've been doing for the last 5 weeks. You were like, nope, I'm nope. doing my thing.
Yeah.
It's not a guilty pleasure.
It's not.
You've already mentioned it. It's Moonstruck.
Yes.
Now, I remember Moonstruck from... the point of view of a child walking around my house
yep.
and my parents watching it. And I sort of have this...
Yes.
I don't think I actually watched it myself, but I remember the film and it yep. being very popular at the time. It was nominated for Oscars.
Yes.
And I watched it.
Did you watch it last night?
I did. It's a very peculiar film.
You know what? So many people say that. It's not. And what's so funny is that if my friend...
That's your comeback. It's
yeah,
not.
It's not. No, it's funny because you've had the exact same reaction that my friend Chris had when I made him watch it. He hadn't watched it for
the listeners, by the way, if someone's listening to this and they're not, then they're kind of going, Moonstruck, I can't think which film
it's
is
Cher
that.
And
describe the plot.
It's Cher, who is a woman in her 40s who is gets
late
proposed
30s.
To by... Is she late 30s? She's...
30,
oh, she's 38. She's 38.
37.
Oh, 37.
Yep.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. So
is that
she,
worrying?
No. I just thought, I always think of her slightly older in that film. But so she is a, she gets proposed to by her kind of boyfriend. She believes in bad luck and she's basically settling for this guy, but she's going to do it because she's been divorced before and it's time. And she's from a big Italian American New York family, et cetera, et cetera. And he goes off to see his mother who is dying. In Italy, and he says, when we get back, we'll get married, but while I'm away, can you do one thing for me? Can you go and tell my brother Ronnie, who I haven't spoken to for years, that I'm getting married because I really want him to come to the wedding? So Cher goes off to tell this brother who she's never met, Nicolas Cage, and they basically fall in love while her husband-to-be is away in Rome.
Which is a brilliant plot.
It's a brilliant premise. It is, now, the reason you say peculiar, and I...
You also didn't mention that Nicolas Cage... has a wooden hand in
yes,
the film.
I think he does a wooden hand, but you know what? It's not a huge... The reason he has a wooden hand and he is that it's part of the blaming of why he hates his brother. Yeah. So it's a plot thing. He accidentally sawed off his hand because his brother distracted him. And therefore, his wife then left him, his fiance left him, and he's never forgiven his brother.
And when I was watching it last night, it did make me kind of go... Oh, yeah.
How good was Nick Cage?
I used to love Nicolas
Cage. So good. You know what? The reason you probably find it peculiar is because it was made in, 83 now or something? 86? I can't remember the actual year.
87.
Is it?
I think it was. I think it was released in 87.
It's a big movie, as in thematically, visually. It's kooky, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's screwball in its kind of very essence of, you know, I mean, he tells her he loves her and she slaps him and says, snap out of it. You know, it's big sort of stuff. But what I adore about it is that it has all these lovely strands that run through it to do with her parents' own, like these subplots that are all about the same thing, all about not settling, all about bad luck, all about the moon, all about like... The world of that film is so rich and it's so simple. And I've seen it probably 50 times, despite not thinking she was in her early 40s. to me, no, films like that never get made anymore. It's like a one-off, you know?
And this is a film where I go, the rom-com element, it feels like it's just one part of the film. It's not... driven purely by, because like you say, there's all these other subplots.
Yeah, but they're all rom-com, they're all romantic comedy subplots.
Some of them aren't comedy though. It's quite a bleak outlook on...
But that, it's still funny. I mean, the fact that guy, so the subplot with the mother, with Olympia Dukakis, when she knows her husband is having an affair, yeah. So she takes herself off to a restaurant and John Mahoney is constantly dumped, you know, by these younger women. And she says to him, you know, why do men, you know, have affairs and fear of death and et cetera, et cetera. Like that's the actual, like the true talent of that film is that it manages to take quite heavy hitting sort of things and make them really fucking wry and funny and interesting angles on stuff. And at the end, they're together, the mum and dad. They look across the table and they say Tiamo to each other, and it's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But it's also funny because Nick Cage is sat there with his wooden hand, and the husband's come back that she's going to marry, and he's like, oh God, or, you know, it's a farce, yeah, basically.
But it's a farce played in this quite sort of almost gothic.
Yes, that's what I mean. It's eccentric. Grand Guignol. Yeah, it's big, it's operatic. Yeah.
And you know, and it's directed by Norman Jewison, who's who did
Rollerball, the other rom-com.
Rollerball, yeah. The Thomas Crown Affair, Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes.
You know, a weird, in terms of, you can't really see the pattern, like, of his choices there, because he liked to do so many different genres. It's... And with this film, I think that's what it feels like. It feels like... I was expecting, because I knew that you wanted to talk about rom-coms, I was expecting it to be much more atypical rom-com.
No.
But it is it's quite dark in places. It's slow.
But that's what I'm saying about not making films like that. People have to just sort of allow their minds to just sort of say, like, it's still structurally what you would expect from a romantic comedy, but the art is to make it into something original and new and different, and put it in, for example, the opera world in Moonstruck gives it that like heightened thing. You know, she's never been to the opera, and he's like, just come with me and then I'll leave you alone, and she goes, and then she has this amazing experience. They do it in Pretty Woman too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, that's must be some sort of homage, I'm sure.
I think also I felt it wasn't that funny.
Honestly, I find it really funny.
You?
Yeah, I do. Do 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 do. All the music. But maybe just because
the music's
like,
funny.
Yeah.
Don't worry, the script's not working, but we'll put funny music in it.
It is funny because, like, in the opening scene, they're like, you know, like her uncle or whatever, and he's like, it's romantically funny. You mm-hmm. know, it's not necessarily laugh out loud.
When Nicolas Cage appears,
yes, then it,
and the reason for why this long feud is revealed. And the hand, and his performance.
I lost my hand.
All and like the way, and then the strange bit where the woman admits that she's in love with him. It just suddenly got really quirky and funny. But up until then, it felt quite. It felt more like a drama that was sort of a bit.
Yeah,
amusing.
But I guarantee you, if you watch it again, like this
already?
Is also you should because this is the other thing is that's what I love about romantic comedies is that most of them get better the more you watch them because you start to
including
see things
including 27 Dresses
include well maybe not 27 Dresses but they definitely like you're I think because you go into it thinking okay this has got to be funny romantic and your brain is like it's like when you watch a thriller you're like when am I going to get scared when am I going to get this when am I going to get that and with romantic comedy you're going oh these people are going to be together and it's your job as a romantic comedy writer is to say to the audience, how the fuck are these two people going to get together? Like, how in God's name are they going to end up as a couple? Like, it's a really hard thing to do because you're essentially putting two people on screen that people know the ending of your film already.
So it's the journey and the puzzle and the...
Yeah, it's and it's the twists and turns that you take that go... Fuck, I didn't see that coming.
By the way, I think we've completely run over.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, Tessa Morris. Tessa Morris sounds more like a politician.
Yes, that's what I mean. It sounds like it's not right, is it?
We've done 1 hour, 44 minutes.
Okay, well, you have fun editing that down. But I talked a lot about my weird, like my, you don't need all that. This rom-com stuff's more interesting than my past.
So to play us out, introduce us to your song. Introduce the song you want to play us out.
I chose In the Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett, which is from The Big Chill, which features, which is one of my all-time favourite films. Another kind of people forget about it, and they should not forget about it.
Lawrence Kasdan, brilliant director that people
forget
always
as well.
Talk about.
Yeah, brilliant writer, and it features at a moment in the film. It's a great montage that includes loads of really brilliant emotional turning point plot stuff, and it's just brilliant. And it's an excellent song, Dan.
It is an excellent song, and you're an excellent guest.
Thank you.
And it's been a pleasure talking to you. See you around sometime.
See you around.